soul was escaping along with the vapor from my nostrils. Hector was feeling his head and wiping the blood off his face. "That thing beat me!" I pushed the barrel of the P226 in his ear. "New rules. Stop complaining." My Colt was still on the top of the van. I figured the big cat was gone, but I still wasn't too hep on the prospect of climbing up there and getting a 223 in my spine. I could always make Hector do it, but I wasn't sure that they wouldn't shoot him, too. I glanced back at the main lodge. "Hey, Hector, do you want to go up there and get my gun?" His eyes looked like ping-pong balls with pupils. "Fuck that!" "That's what I figured." I glanced at him. "So they're all holding up in the lodge." He didn't say anything, so I nudged his ear with the SIG, reinforcing the rules. "Yeah, yeah. They're in the lodge thing." "They've got the FBI agent, the blonde woman?" "Yeah, they got her." I made some quick calculations and took the barrel of the gun away from his head. "What about the other Meritrans guy?" He looked at me for a moment. "Yeah, they got him too." I wondered briefly why they hadn't simply killed him, but it was possible that they were smart enough to realize that they should hang on to all potential hostages. "What about Beatrice Linwood?"
"Who?"
"I need you to pay attention, Hector," I sighed. "The waitress from South Fork Lodge, the one that served us lunch."
"Oh, Shades, bitch. Yeah, hey, that dude's crazy. He said there are ghosts all over these mountains and that they talk to him."
I stared at him, and fortunately, he misinterpreted.
"I'm not kidding. He says there are hundreds of them all around watching us."
He wiped the blood out of his eyes.
"He's fucking crazy, man."
I looked down at the top of his head and could see the four grooves where the big cat had gotten him. It was a good thing he had had that hood, or it would have been worse. I figured I'd play on it. "You might need some stitches."
"Hey, no shit. I'm bleeding to death here."
I looked around at our situation and wasn't overcome with confidence. The only positive thing I could think of was that I had all the modes of transportation and a pretty good vantage point. Of course, there was also the opportunity to freeze to death before the sun came up in the morning. The gangbanger looked up at me.
"Hey, you know I wasn't going to shoot you, right?"
I kept my eyes on the porch of the lodge, but couldn't see anything amidst the streaking snow. "Well, I appreciate that, Hector."
"Yeah, I mean, I was just supposed to slow you down till they got that thing going."
I studied him. "What thing?"
"The tank thing."
"Hector, what are you talking about?" He wiped more blood off his face with his sleeve.
"When we got the van stuck, Shade said you'd be the one that would come after us, that the dead Indians told him."
He tapped the front of the Suburban with a hand.
"When you got here, we'd take your truck, but then one of the other guys, the guy they call Fingers, he found the tank thing in the shed behind the lodge and said he could get it going if we gave him enough time."
I seemed to remember an old surplus Thiokol Model 601 Sprite Snowcat that had been brought up from the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs back in the mid-70s for use at the ski resort near Meadowlark Lake. So much for keeping them pinned, but how far and how fast did they think they were going to go in a snowcat? If I were them, I'd still try for the Fed Suburban. I stood and checked for the keys to the SUV, which were still in my pocket, and then tapped Hector on the shoulder. "Come on." He looked up at me but didn't move.
"Why?"
Slitting my eyes to guard against the snow, I glanced across the hood. "We're going to go break up the party." He settled into the parka, which was a good two sizes too big for him.
"Fuck that!"
I looked down at him and snorted, losing a little more of my soul through my nose. I raised my eyes and tried to sound indifferent. "Suit yourself, but with you bleeding like you are, and alone, I'll bet that hungry mountain lion comes back." There wasn't much cover between the cabins and the lodge, and I was going to have to hustle between them in open view of whoever was shooting the assault rifle, occupying myself by thinking about how many wrong career choices I'd made to lead me to this lovely pass. I stood at the front of the van, shrugged the strap of Sancho's pack onto my shoulder, and took a few deep breaths. I jolted forward and to the right, post-holing only one step in the open. I slammed against the notched corner of the other cabin, but didn't hear anything. I was tempted to wave my hat, but figured I'd already pressed my luck, and anyway, I liked my hat. I motioned for Hector to follow me. I'd cuffed him, but figured his legs should still work fine. He shook his head and brought his hands together in a praying gesture. I'd given him the option of going first, but he'd said he'd rather follow. I guess he was having second thoughts now. I yelled above the wind, "Come on!" Say what you want about the small man. He was agile and fast. He ran into my shoulder and stood there panting. "You do that again, and I'll leave you out here." His eyes circled the immediate vicinity, and I could only guess how many phantom cougars he was seeing. I stayed close to the cabin, careful to slip under the window, and continued to my right. If I remembered correctly, there was a straight shot to the lodge up ahead, but we had to go through another opening between the next two cabins before we could get there. I waited at the corner and hoped that when I made my mad dash, somebody wouldn't be waiting on the other side with a riot gun. I stood there a while just to break up the rhythm. I thought of Santiago's cell phone in my pocket, but didn't want to open it out here in the dark. It'd be like a beacon for bullets. I shrugged the strap of the pack farther up on my shoulder and launched across. My back flattened against the logs of the next cabin about halfway down the row, and I looked back at Hector. He was still panting and held up a finger. After a moment, he threw himself into the opening, slipped in the snow, and fell to his knees, finally scrambling across on all fours. I grabbed him by his collar and stood him up beside me. "I think after that epic display of cat-like grace, we can safely say that they're not keeping too close a watch on us." "Fuck you, man!" He chapped his struggling mustache in his lower lip. "That shit's slippery." "Stay here until I motion for you." He nodded. "I'm good with that." I continued around the cabin and peered past the corner. It was a straight shot of about 30 yards to the side of the main lodge, but with the oblique angle of the lodge windows, we had a reasonable chance of taking them by surprise. There was a large lean-to shed behind the building with a set of steps that probably led to the kitchen. I was thinking that might be just the opening I needed. The wind continued to pick up, and I imagined it was blowing at a 30-mile-an-hour clip. The snow on the roadway between us and the lodge was a little over ankle deep, but after watching Hector's ice capades, I wasn't so sure we could make it before being discovered. I leaned back against the logs and waved for him. "Hey, Sheriff, are there more of you true blues coming?"
"Lots of them."
"Are they bringing food and stuff?"
I glanced at him.
"What, are you hungry again?"
"Yeah, and that bitch only brought that freeze-dried shit."
"Beatrice brought supplies?"
"Uh-huh, food packs, even snowshoes."
Well, double hell. Why would she go to the trouble of bringing freeze-dried food, packs and snowshoes? Where were they going that they needed these kinds of provisions? All things considered, the sooner they were stopped, the better. I turned to look at Hector. "We're going to hustle across to the lodge, and my advice to you is to keep up. If they even think they see people moving around out here, they're just the type to shoot first and identify the bodies later. Got me?" He didn't look enthused with the elegant simplicity of my plan.
"Yeah."
"Ready?"
He shook his head.
"No."
"All right, then, let's go." I rushed forward, the wet snow sticking to my right side like plaster of Paris. All of a sudden, the whiteout was so thick you could have cut sheep out of the air with a sharp knife. I stumbled once and could hear Hector's breath at my back. The drifts got deep toward the lodge where the snow had whistled against the building and had settled in a steep upgrade that wasn't there anymore. I stopped at the base of the steps and clung to the railing, the air in my lungs feeling like battery acid. Hector stumbled onto the first step.
"Hey, we're not going to stay out here, are we?"
I swallowed and grabbed my breath by the tail ends.
"No."
I listened. Something didn't sound right. The noise was coming from my right, and I'd just about made up my mind that it was just the wind striking the corner of the building when the keening increased its pitch. I grabbed Hector as the padlocked barn door of the shed blew apart, with the majority of the nearest 12-foot door tumbling on top of us. The metal bars of the railings, which were set in the concrete steps, held the weight of the thing above us, but it shifted when something very big rolled over the wooden planks, first raising them and then slapping them down on us again. The wood splintered this time, but the railings held, and Hector and I crawled toward the building, toward the only opening afforded us. I was the first to get clear of the shattered remains of the shed and slid up at the corner of the lodge in time to see the big, weathered blue shoebox of a 601 Sprite Snowcat pivot a few times as the driver attempted to get a feel for the thing. He finally got the 32-inch tracks going in the direction he wanted, which happened to be into the parked Suburban. The thiocol thundered into the side of the Chevrolet, pushing it onto the porch of one of the cabins. The porch collapsed, and the SUV was buried in the rubble. The 601 pivoted again, and I could see the primer patches on it. The U.S. Air Force 6385-443 designation was still painted on the back, along with, scripted below, for official use only. I raised the .40 and aimed at the small windows in the thing, but what was I going to shoot and whom? I allowed the SIG to slip to my side as the snowcat pivoted once again, climbed the small embankment, and turned left on West Tensleep Road. Left. I ducked my head down and peered into the gloom and blowing snow just to make sure I'd seen what I'd seen. They weren't heading for the paved road to the south, but north, up the snow-covered, dead-end road toward West Tensleep Lake. Left. I watched as they continued toward the bridge, easily maneuvering over the drift that had stopped me flat, the motor accelerating in the distance, until the noise mingled with the wind and was gone. "This ain't fair!" As if to demonstrate the cruelty of my act, Hector yanked at the handcuffs that secured him to the water pipes. "What if that fucking tiger comes back?" I finished patching his head with the available medical supplies and the first aid kit under the counter. He looked like he was wearing a gauze beanie, but at least the bleeding had stopped for good. I stuffed a few of the water bottles I had found into the Basco's pack and tossed one to Hector. "Here!" He caught the bottle with his free hand and sat back on the chair I'd provided for him behind the counter beside the cash register next to the payphone. "What am I supposed to do?" I needed to make more room in the pack, so I emptied it and arranged the items on the round table in the dining area of Deerhaven Lodge. Sizer Vittoria had scrounged up a pretty good amount of candy bars, a bag of Funyuns, and a few cans of Coke. I axed the pop. The water was what I was going to need. Around these parts, we'd drink it. "I mean about the tiger." I pulled the cell phone out of my pocket and from the plastic bag. I planned to place it in the nifty little pouch on the outside of the pack so that I could find it later. First, though, I flipped it open and looked at the battery indicator, which read about 3/4, and then at the signal indicator, which read nothing. There was no service. It was just as well, since I was going to feel pretty silly telling everybody about how I'd found the escaped convicts, but, after being shot at and pretty much hit with a barn door, had allowed them to escape. On a whim, I went over to the payphone next to Hector, picked up the receiver, and clicked the toggle. There was a dial tone. I dialed 911.
"Absaroka County Sheriff's Department."
"I'd like to report a storm in Maybury." She practically screamed.
"Where are you?"
"Nestled in the heart of the Bighorn Mountains." Ruby calmed a little, but was adamant.
"Where exactly?"
"Deerhaven Lodge, at the cutoff to West Tensleep Lake."
"What are you doing there?"
"Hell is empty, and all the devils are here."
"Have you found them?"
"One down, 4 to go." I held the phone out. "Say hello, Hector." He lurched forward, the handcuffs rattling against the pipe.
"Hey, this guy's crazy, and there's a fucking tiger up here."
I returned the phone to my ear and lodged it against my shoulder as I buckled up the main cavity of the pack. "Hector will be at the main lodge when they get here. He's a little excitable. Speaking of which, where's my backup?"
"They're on their way from both sides of the mountain. Joe Ironcloud, Tommy Wayman, and about a division of highway patrol and search and rescue are on their way from the west, but the switchbacks in Tensleep Canyon are filled with drifts. Henry and Vic, with an even larger contingency, are on their way up from our side, but I haven't heard anything from them in over an hour. I'd imagine they're encountering the same conditions."
"Maybe worse. Hey, you didn't say over." She sighed, but I could still tell my dispatcher was slightly amused.
"It's a phone, Walter. You don't use radio procedures on a phone."
"Ruby, the remaining convicts stole a snowcat from the lodge here and are headed up West Tensleep Road. Give a call to everybody and let them know what's going on."
"They went up the trailhead road?"
"Yep, maybe they think it comes out somewhere. Boy, are they going to be surprised when all they find is a parking lot and some porta-potties." I shifted the receiver to my other ear as Hector watched. "Sancho loaned me his cell, but there's no service." I read her the number in case she didn't have it handy. "He says that if I get one of the Fed satellite phones, it should work. I would imagine they're sequential, so just add a digit to the end of the one he called you on, and you'll probably have the number. Read me his, and I'll put it in Sancho's mobile." I leaned against the wall and shared a look with Otero as I repeated the number she read to me.
Sancho still back at Meadowlark with McGroder, the convicts took Pfaff and one of the Ameritrans personnel. All the rest of the federal agents and marshals are dead.
There was a long pause as I waited for the lecture that was coming.
Walter, if they've gone north on that road, there's no way for them to escape. You should wait until someone gets there.
I thought about the private cabins up here and the hostages. I think it's better to keep close to them and know where they are.
Alone?
Yep, well, manpower seems to be pretty much at a shortage up here. There was an even longer pause.
Do you have your radio with you?
It would only be helpful if there was line of sight, and if they got within 30 miles of me, sans weather conditions. But I figured I'd keep that little nugget of information to myself. Yes, ma'am.
It'll only be good if they get within 30 miles, but it makes me feel better knowing that you've got it.
Uh-huh.
I'll give the cell and the potential satellite number to everyone.
I listened to her breathing on the other end. I gotta head out.
You do realize it's 2 o'clock in the morning?
That's okay. It's a weekend, and I'm becoming something of a night owl. Ruby, aware of the Northern Cheyenne belief that owls were messengers from the great beyond, didn't take mention of them lightly.
Don't talk about owls.
What, you're starting to believe the heathen red man's sorcery?
Let's just say I'm playing it safe.
Good night, Ruby. I hung up the payphone and then palmed open Sizer Pretoria's cell to check again. Still nothing. I looked at the screensaver of Sancho's wife, Marie, holding their son Antonio. I sighed, turned it off, and slipped the device into the Ziploc. Then I tried to put it into the outside compartment of the Basco's pack, but it wouldn't fit. I unzipped the compartment, pulled out a paperback, and turned it over. The cover art was a detail, the Damned of the Last Judgment, from the 14th-century cupola mosaic in the baptistry in Florence. A very large blue devil appeared to be munching on the unfortunate next to a sticker that proclaimed, "New Translation by Robin Kirkpatrick." I peeled through the pages, Italian on the left, English translation on the right. That Basco. The first page caught my eye. "At one point midway on our path in life, I came around and found myself searching through a dark wood, the right way blurred and lost." Boy, howdy. I walked over and stood there, looking out the windows for a second, then closed the Penguin Classic and popped it back in the pack. I picked up the SIG semi-automatic from the table, palming the clip and thumbing the remaining rounds into my pocket. Body and soul. Crime and punishment. Law and order. "How about you give me that gun?" I'd all but forgotten about him. I turned and gave my attention to Hector as I buttoned my sheepskin coat and slapped the mag back in the grip. "I'm not sure how they do things down Texas way, but we try to keep guns out of the hands of convicted killers up here in Wyoming." I came back over, sat in one of the chairs, and tossed the SIG onto the counter between us. He immediately snatched it up and pointed it at me. "Besides, it's empty." He pulled the action and then dropped the clip just to make sure. He tossed it back onto the counter. "What if that tiger comes back?" I rubbed my face with my hands. "Hector, I don't think a mountain lion is going to be bold enough to break down the door to get in here, even if she feels like a little Mexican." "Fuck you!" He looked past me toward the fireplace. "Hey, give me that stick from over there, huh?" I glanced behind me, and sure enough there was a walking staff with a leather loop on one end, and tacked on the shaft a number of tiny metal plates commending the places the stick and its owner had gone. I walked over and took it from the freestanding coat rack, behind which were hung an old pair of strung gut willow snowshoes. There was also the outline of something that must have been hanging next to them, like a rug, maybe, or a skin of some sort. There was a buffalo thing or something hanging up there. Shay took it with him. Now, why would he do that? I looked at the bare paw pattern snowshoes again. Waste not, want not. I pulled them off the wall and stuffed them under my arm, walked back and handed the stick to Hector. There you go. He slapped the thicker end of the 5-foot staff against the flattened palm of his cuffed hand to test the weight and seemed satisfied. Cool. His eyes came back up to the antique snowshoes under my arm. Are you really going after them in this friggin' blizzard? Yep.
He paused, but then blurted out,
You should wait for some help. I'm just saying.
I pulled the brim of my hat down to set it against the wind and started examining the buckles and leather straps on the snowshoes. That seems to be the consensus. His voice became flat.
No, really. I seen some guys in my life, Sheriff, but that Shade, he's crazy bad.
I nodded and sat in the chair in an attempt to get the straps over my boots. As I rested my chest against one of my knees, I thought about just staying there like that and maybe taking a nap. Who was I kidding? I wasn't in any shape to head out into a blizzard in the middle of the night after a bunch of homicidal maniacs. Then the other voice in my head got me to thinking that they wouldn't make it very far, probably would choose to hole up in one of the cabins farther up the road, or possibly at the Tyrell Ranger Station. I'd try not to be as conspicuous as I had been. I'd just keep an eye on them till the troops arrived. Just keep an eye on them. At least, that's what I was telling myself. I got up, smiling at his concern. Thanks, Hector. Just for laughs, I hit the remote on the Suburban. The horn tooted, and the lights flashed from under the collapsed porch. The left rear tire was flat, and the quarter panel had been pushed up into the wheel well. I could probably get it going if I had the jaws of life, parts, and a day to work on it. I loped along on the surface of the snow against the blowing wind. It was a little tough, but I got the front of the snowshoe in the open back doorway of the DOC van and pulled myself up, glancing more than once at the alcove on the adjacent cabin where the cougar had appeared. Nothing, just more snow. I scrambled my hand around on the top of the Dodge till I found my 1911 and pulled it toward me, banging the collected snow off and returning it to my holster as I hung on to the back drip rail. My eyes clung to the mountain lion print closest to me, and I was reminded of just how big she was. I was glad now that I'd moved one of the benches from the porch in front of the door of the lodge. The sound of my snowshoes landing was muffled by the snow, and I turned toward Ten Sleep Road, but froze. The big cat hadn't gone far and stood in plain view underneath the lone light on the power pole, her 8-foot-long body pale in the halo of the falling snow. She looked at me from over her shoulder, and I was beginning to think that this was extremely odd behavior. It was possible that she was just angry with Hector and me for driving her from her temporary lair. But it didn't seem that way. It was almost as if she was saddened and, even with the reception I'd given her, unhappy to leave. It was probably warmer in the little corner of the roof she'd found. Pulling the .45 from my holster, I waved it at her, but she just stood there looking at me. A gust of snow blew from the collapsed roof, striking my face like sand, and ducking slightly away, I closed my eyes. When I reopened them, she was gone, and the flakes continued to float down in the circle of light like the spotlight on an empty stage, and it was as if she hadn't been there at all. Chapter 6 They'd blown through the piled-up berm at the bridge. The dual tracks of the Thiokol Sprite were almost 3 feet wide leading up West Tensleep Road, but it was easier to just walk between the tread marks in my borrowed snowshoes. That wasn't why I was standing there, unmoving. After they'd busted through, they had stopped. You could see where the snowcat had steered slightly to the right. I pulled my maglite from my duty belt and shined it on the tracks, hoping I'd see an oil or fuel leak. There were a few drops, but nothing that was going to slow the behemoth. My eyes were drawn to something leading to the snowbank, what looked like a different kind of leak, possibly antifreeze. I stood there looking at what was illuminated by my flashlight, which, like the light in the parking lot, provided a center stage spot for a curtain call or maybe a prologue. Pissed in the snowbank was a single word. Abandon. Renault Shade had pretty good handwriting, considering the instrument. Abandon. He'd seen the Basco reading the Inferno. He left the message for me and evidently hadn't had the bladder capacity to finish the stanza. Hope, all ye who enter here. The warning above the gates of hell, in Dante's opus. Maybe he'd seen a similarity between our situation and that of the Italian poet. The wind pressed at my back, and the flakes swirled around, but the impromptu calling card stayed there, as if he'd written it in molten lead. It was about a mile up to the Battle Park cutoff, where I assumed they'd turned west and try for the Hyattville Road that led toward the tiny town and eventually to Manderson, which was situated alongside the Bighorn River. Then what? North to Basin or south to Warland? Try as I might, I couldn't see what they were gaining by going off-road. They, and by they I meant Shade, had to know that there would be an entire law enforcement army waiting for them when they got off the mountain in either direction. There were no roads that connected the north side of the Bighorns with the south side, and the only substantial trail that led east was over Florence Pass near Bomber Mountain and Cloud Peak toward the Hunter Corrals. Florence Pass was more than 11,000 feet, and if they'd tried that, they were likely to solve society's problems on their own, which was fine for the convicts, but not for the two hostages. A lot of people made the mistake of heading up West Tensleep in the hopes that it led somewhere besides Cloud Peak, a 13,167-foot glaciated monolith, seventh largest in Wyoming, with a vertical mass of one minor and three major cirques that supported its own weather pattern. The Crow, Cheyenne, and Lakota venerated Cloud Peak as a place to bestow gifts of redemption and to retrieve Iwaki, or the mud that heals. In 1887, U.S. Engineer W.S. Stanton, the white mountaineer who claimed to have conquered the mountain's west slope first, discovered medicine bundles and a bivouac that the Indians had left behind. So much for being first. Abandon. The message pissed in the snow kept invading my thoughts as I trudged on, my snowshoes keeping me on the surface of the snow. The history of Wyoming alpinism unable to wipe the urinated message from my mind. The trees on either side of the road had sheltered the way so far, and I appreciated the protection, but the weight of the snow was already taking its toll, and I could hear heavy branches cracking and falling like severed limbs. There was a consistent wind, and I ducked my hat against the gusts as the snow continued to dart down at a 30-degree angle. At least, it wasn't adhering itself to me like it had in the open spaces back at Deer Haven. But I could tell that the temperature was dropping. I figured there wasn't much need to be concerned about being ambushed. Just the steady slog of working my way higher into the range and staying between the wide tracks of the surplus snowcat. If I fell into one of the troughs, I knew I was off course. The collar of my sheepskin coat had attached itself to the left side of my face, and the narrow V-shaped aperture that I looked through allowed me only a limited view of the road ahead, so I was more than a little surprised when suddenly there was the glare of a lot of lights and the thrum of internal combustion from a fast-moving, highly lifted 4x4. I bounced off the Jeep's grill and threw myself to the right, but the vehicle had slowed and missed rolling over my legs by about a foot as it slid to a stop. I lay there for a moment and then started getting up. The snowshoes were cumbersome, and it took me a while to stand and